finish today. So the key thing that we're looking at in this area of the eighth hour is this is the beginning of the movement of ascent. And so this encounter that we've been having with the serpent guardian, whose eyes are shut, who invites us into the serpent dreaming, and all this attention to energy rising up, is absolutely about this phase of the Book of Gates, because we've now gone into the deepest depths, we've encountered what we've encountered, we're now starting to rise up. Now, if we look at if we come back to the three registers of the Book of Gates, at the top register, we've got these guys holding a first 12 people holding a rope, 12 people holding a serpent. Well, I'm actually on Eric Horning's book, but I'll tell you what the page it begins on. So
180.
Yeah, begins on the page 180, but for some reason they haven't given a very good illustration of the figures there. But anyway, it starts off
it is.
This particular section they haven't done very well, I don't think, because they've only included some of the images and we haven't got the three registers laid out properly. Anyway, it's done, whatever it is. But anyway, the top register begins with these figures that are straightening out a rope and new life is emerging out of that. Now, this experience of making straight and allowing energy is why this is one of the reasons why we've been concentrating so much on the middle pillar exercise this weekend. Because we, in a sense, are creating this straight channel and allowing energy to rise. The other set of figures you get at the top register are the ones who are straightening out a rope and stars are arising, and this is this again has this idea of working with time, working with cyclicity, and working with the present moment. Again, comes back to this idea of working with the middle pillar, working with letting the serpent energy arise within us. Now, in the middle section of the book of Gates, we have the usual Bark of Ra, and then we have a whole load of guys holding the Waz scepter and the symbol of the Ankh. Now, these are called the Masters of Bestowing. We'll find the page. So that you'll find in page 186. These are the masters of what is bestowed in the West. And these figures, which you find the version of them repeated in the lower register as well, are all about being able to remain balanced and make correct judgments when the new energy is rising. So the phrases you get here are, assembly who are at the Duat, in the Duat, masters of what is bestowed in the West, separate you me through your separations, allot you what is evil to my adversaries, in accordance with my giving to you my truth. Let your ordinance be in according to your separations, what I have undergone in accordance with the gods. Say they to Ra, true a voice are you, Ra, resisting your adversaries. Now your conditions are as our conditions. For you are that from which we have come forth. Our creation is for the salvation of its presence. Your portions are yours in the exulting earth. The West is for your hallowed remains, and your portions are yours in Nut, that's the stars. Now your presence may rule the heavens. Putting forth what is there on earth means taking as friends the masters of what is bestowed. Now, what this line is indicating is in this process of rising up, of letting the energy rise up, of making straight the rope and allowing the energy to rise, what is essential is a process of judgment where you are able to keep yourselves balanced. And keep yourself and so the keep talking there about separation, which is about allowing this process of shedding, separating yourself from the images, from the forms that keep you trapped in an old way of being. Now, the bottom register gives us 12 mummy form figures, which you'll find on page 189, some of them anyway. Now, these are figures that are like sphinxes. And they're lying on a bed, but they're slightly raised up. They're in the posture of the sphinx, in effect. So that means they're not supine. They're just, their bodies are slightly raised up. And we can tell they're human beings because they've got the square beard rather than the pointy beard of a god. Now, this again is a representation of the beginning of the energy of rising, but it also, because it is a sphinx, it presents the energy of challenge and of having to get past the riddle of the sphinx. So one of the things it's paying attention to or showing us is the fact that as energy rises, we are confronted by difficulty, we are confronted by challenge, by something that we have to unriddle. Now, what the text says about this, these are the radiant who are dutiful and potent, the radiant who are skillful. Says to them, hidden mysteries, O the radiant, aho the underworlders, opening for you, zealous ones, uncovering of your pregnant darkness. Radiance is of your presence, potency is for your shadow, wisdom for your mouth, valor for your heart, raising up for your support, breath for your noses, delightful odor for your oils, unraveling for your wrappings. You depart and you come back. You have come into power in your cold refreshment. Be acclaimed, presences, be quick, and you can walk off with utterances. Though you be at peace in peacefulness, receive for yourself your cold refreshment. From the sunny lakes of the Duat, stand erect, you who are in the possession of the opening of daybreak, which ascends a radiant one belonging to he of the Aket. May you be dazzling inside, as shall be your covering. Your brightness is the sunshine of Ra. Open for you is the silent land, being its equal. You shall alter the hallows of Seat of the Eye, that means the hallows of Osiris. Aho to you, the radiant one. They exist upon their supports, they are spending the night upon their beds. Their extension is bread, their scale pans are hallowed vessels, their cold refreshment is water. Now, putting forth what is theirs on earth means being radiant, skillful, powerful, and a shadow. Now, a lot in there, but it's really describing that process of rising up. And the rising up of everything, including shadow and light. So you are light, but there's also shadow. Now that's, again, quite graphically illustrating the process that happens as we work in this inner way. Light happens, we experience ourselves standing erect, we experience our luminosity. Then the next moment we experience shadow, we experience the potency of the energy of the oppositional energy also. Now the final scene you get in the eighth hour is 12 figures who are called the Assembly of Separations. And this is page 191. They are those who separate at this gate, hearing the conditions of those who are in it. Says to them Ray, so, oho, our gods, assembly of separations, separating the mortal, saving presences, what is being divined, being placed on its base. Your truth is yours, gods. Say they to Ray, oho, he of the Aket, great god, master of nine, now we work at separating what is mortal, now we save the radiant, they who are developing. We give peace to a god who is upon his base. Their extension is bread, their scale pans are hallowed vessels, their cold refreshment is water. Putting forth what is theirs on earth means being separated in the assembly. Well, that's the end of the eighth hour. Now, this whole concentration upon separation is this alchemical principle called separatio, where you, instead of the light and the darkness being mixed inside you and achieving a stability by the darkness diminishing the light and the light somehow stabilizing the darkness, what happens in this process of ascent is your being is magnified. So that in that place there is a need for the old fusion of light and dark to be broken down and separated, so that the shadow or the restrictive energies can be shed, like a snake skin is shed. Now, what happens?
You consciously bring up both the light and the shadow. You ascend with both.
Well, you don't. You consciously bring up the power. You bring up the energy. It's the bringing up of the energy. It's the rising of the serpent power itself that energizes whatever is there, and therefore energizes what is both light and shadow, and then puts it into high relief. So how that works in practice is some of the things that people have been saying, where you have a powerful experience and then the next experience is very disappointing. Or you it's that moment where you think you've made it, you feel completely in tune with the universe, and the next minute you feel shut out of everything and you know you're never going to have that experience again. So it's that sequential empowerment, really, that where the light and the shadow are both awakened by the arising energy. And so that's, you know, it's the key thing is just simply to keep working. Whether the experience is good or bad, you just keep on with the process. Because what starts to happen, assuming that you work, and that's why you have to work in a balanced way. This is why in the beginning, at the top register, they talk you at this place of make straight the path. Because in this, what you find in the Book of Gates, they're really laying down very graphically the conditions for this work of ascension working. So you straighten the rope to allow the energy to come. You work patiently with time, both the immediacy of time and the repetition of time. You work at this process of contemplating Mart, discovering what is true and what is balanced. You work with the process of separatio, of shedding that which is no longer needed. And these are all the consequences of bringing up this energy. And in a way, the two things I suppose that we've most concentrated on is in these 2 days is deepening our experience of the middle pillar and bringing up the energy of that, but also it's engaging with this great archetype of the serpent woman, who is Renenutet in the Egyptian tradition, who in Avalonian tradition you could say is Melusine. But who represents this very ancient human image, really, of the serpent, who can be both darkness and light, but who possesses the secret of continual transformation. So in terms of the month to come, working with the deepening your experience of the middle pillar, working also with the serpent image, going into the Duat, engaging with the serpent mother. And letting her and increasingly allowing her to take control of the work is the essential thing, in a way.
Even as she sleeps.
Yes. Well, in a certain sense, as I was saying earlier, we are, in some ways, she sleeps within us. We are the product of her dreaming. So engaging in entering into that serpent dreaming is that experience of entering consciously into the consciously into her experience. And her dreams in some ways are powerful. So as you enter into that, then it's a way, it's what we do when we go into the inner, when we trust the deep imagination, and that we're following the coils of the serpent dreaming, you could say.
What is she our higher self?
Can I just finish this?
Yeah, go on.
So as we're doing the middle pillar, if a sense of the snake ascending comes,
go with it.
That's a sense of a dream, part of the dream, or.
Well, it's the dream in that case mobilizing, the image mobilizing and becoming conscious, isn't it? So if that happens, that's part of the energy of the dream coming into the exercise and energizing it. So it's that place really where we're looking at the, what we're doing here is really looking at the, when we're working with the sleeping serpent, we're looking at this energy of sleep and waking, consciousness and unconsciousness. So we're using images. So the sleeping serpent is the image of the great reservoir of life and consciousness within us that is not yet active. And the exercises are designed to enable that energy to become active. So if you find this image of the serpent coming up in you, it's arising out of that sleeping place, becoming present in the conscious experience in that moment.
But it's not something to be sort of nudged.
No, that happens spontaneously. So you can't as an effort of will wake it up. It happens obliquely really by doing the exercises.
Thank you. Thanks.
Pleasure. Somebody else.
Sorry, Ed, I was trying to come into this thing about whether she's a higher self or whether she's a daimon or how we regard her, really. Maybe not, because she's bigger than that.
Well, that's a big question, really. It's not a personal. She's not a personal possession. It's the greater life It's the greater life energy that works in a sense. You could say it's the sort of great creative energy of the universe working through us, in us. So as we create a relationship with Renanutit, with the Serpent Mother, of course, as we create relationship, she becomes part of us. We become part of her. But we are working essentially with a sort of an energy of creation. In Hindu tradition, she would be called Shakti. She would be called the mother who makes the worlds. You know, so it's a sort of divine quality really that is coming, that we're inviting in to our personal frame to energize and enable us to become more fully ourselves. Not just our personal selves really, but in a sense our transcendental selves, you could say.
Ian, before you've said a number of times in different contexts, the serpent is the messiah, looking at the numerology.
Yeah.
And I think this is the first time I've really got that fact of going, oh, well, of course, there's something about not just coming into relationship with the serpent, but being the serpent, therefore one is the changing one, and the messiah is the changing one.
Totally, that's exactly it, right? So that's exactly the idea behind that, where that's why the serpent is the savior. So as we, in a way, as we learn to trust that energy, as we learn to allow it to mold us, to, with like Ali's image of the python molding her into shapes, that in a way, that's the difficult thing and the scary thing, I think, about relating this energy, is ultimately you surrender to it and you allow it to move through you. There's a wonderful example of this within the 19th century Hindu holy man Ramakrishna, who was a devotee of the goddess Kali, and he went through a whole process of surrendering to Kali. He was a priest of Kali in Calcutta. And she brought him into an understanding of the universality of all religions, so that he, at different stages, became a practitioner of different religions, because she wanted him to. And in a way, it's that devotee, it's that devotion to the goddess, to the feminine creative principle. That is one of the lost principles here in the West. That is, you know, so it's our mother beneath the ground who makes the world. And as we align with that and allow her to shape us, to form us, to be as a mother to us, and teach us how it is to, be a true human being. And in a sense, that's the sort of the learning here somewhere. It is, you become the child of the mother. You allow her to shape you, to show you the way, and in whatever way. And there's a great book by I think of Ramakrishna, a book called Kali's Child by the guy's surname is Kripal. Actually, I've got his book here. Jeffrey Kripal wrote a book called Kali's Child, where he's looking at the way in which Ramakrishna's devotion to the mother transformed him and made him into this extraordinary teacher, really. Rather wild tantric teacher, really, in fact, who kind of could take any shape. And in a way, I suppose the reason I mention him is because he, because of his devotion to her, he could take any shape depending on what she required of him somewhere, you know. And in a way, that's the quality that comes to us as we align with this energy, as we give ourselves over to this energy. We, like her, become capable of any shape, any form that's needed. But in order to do that, of course, our rigidities have to be dissolved. Our sense of who we are has to become much more fluid and much more responsive and much freer, in a way. And so at this point where the energy is starting to rise, what happens is you get a collision between our rigidity and our desire for stability. So that's where things start to get a bit messy. Because ultimately we have to learn to find stability in change, not stability in stasis. Now our problem is we're all the time trying to find stability in stasis by referring back to an imagined past. Whereas actually what we have to do is to discover the stability and the safety within change and insecurity. And that is only possible through by discovering that we can trust the divine as it meets us.
You've let go of the side of the pool, haven't you?
Yeah, and that's not easy, you know. It's a sort of, you know, and when you think about learning to swim for the first time, when you do that, you let go, you drift a bit, then you fucking panic and grab your way back to the poolside again and grip on even harder. I mean, that's the natural reaction in some ways.
Very Buddhist.
Well, it's very, very human, isn't it? I mean, it's in most of the spiritual traditions. That's the big problem always with human beings, is our the way in which we grip onto the past and our inability and our fear of the future, fear of the stranger, fear of the other.
Just very struck by the crucifixion.
Yeah.
Or the fixed cross.
Yeah.
Someone wrote to it. It's literally as fixed as. You know,
oh,
it's almost counter to that.
Well, it is. Well, it is in a way, isn't it? I mean, in a sense, if you think of the way in which the cross, I was just thinking then about the way the cross is used, or the crucifix is used. It's used often as a device to shame people or to tell them that Christ has died for you, and therefore you should be this way. You know, it's used as it's a fixated image used to try and fixate others. You know, and rather than some of these other images which are about, if you take the serpent image, it's all about change and movement. You know, there's sort of the whole thing about Buddhism involves the idea of releasing your grip. You know, and these are very different images from images that are designed to get us. And this is part of the problem, I think, of Western culture, is that we are built around this idea of goodness and badness, and that powerful sense of original sin and original shame that makes it very difficult for us to trust our deeper energies.
We risk being crucified, don't we? Because Jesus went before the court. And he didn't say anything because he knew he wouldn't be heard.
It's interesting. Yes, exactly. And it's interesting when we think of Jesus, because there are some very early traditions of about Jesus as a shaman and as a shapeshifter. There's in the sort of in some of the Aramaic literature, first century literature, around the arrest of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, that Judas had to be there to identify him, because everybody knows that Jesus would change his shape all the time, so you wouldn't know who, you wouldn't be able to recognize him, because it would depend on what shape he was taking. Because when you get back to the roots of Christianity, you get back to something that's very similar to some of these things that we're talking about. Before it becomes turned into a political religion, from as a result of Constantine's desire to have a religion that would unify the empire. You know, you get a very, very powerful thing that happens in early Christian culture, where there's a debate between somebody called Irenaeus and somebody called Valentinius to discover what's going to be the emperor calls this debate in order to decide which should be the favored form of Christianity in the Roman Empire. And Valentinius is a Gnostic and who's interested in inner experience and talks about the inner Christ and talks about transformation in ways that we would understand. Irenaeus is very much the man waving the cross and telling people, separating people into heretics and true believers. Now, for Constantine, who was an authoritarian nightmare despot, really, the idea of a religion where you could take control of people's minds and tell them who they should be and control them more easily was an inevitable lure, really. So Valentinius gets dismissed, and the form of Christianity that Irenaeus is raising up becomes the official religion of the Roman Empire. And what the emperor and subsequent emperors find is that Christianity is a brilliant tool for getting people to do what they're told, because you can manipulate them not just by force or by force of arms, but by manipulating people through shame and the sense of original guilt. And in a way, you see, that's one of the, you know, and of course, alongside all of this, you get these heretical traditions, Gnostic traditions, things like the Kabbalah, things that run alongside Western culture. But the dominant narrative always is this image of the Christ died for me, therefore I must obey and be a good person. And this is always used by whatever people are in power, in order to get people to do what they're told. You know, those of us who are a bit older who will have been brought up in education where Christianity was quite a strong force will remember being told lots of times about how how spontaneous behavior is wrong and can lead us into sinful ways. When I had a particular experience of that, because I went to a convent school to begin with, you know, and I remember one of the nuns once talking with horror about some poor hapless girl who was eating a bun in public. And you'd swear she was inviting blokes to shag her against the wall, in the way this was being talked about. I like to joke about it myself, but actually this was powerful, you know. This is a way of these controlling energies getting right inside you, so you end up believing that there is this malevolent divine figure watching you to work out when you're going to do something wrong.
That Remembrance Sunday, isn't it, and how we hold the war now and how it's been hijacked, yeah. Compared to actually we should be remembering those who died.
Absolutely. No, I think that's what happens. And of course this is always what happens, I think, with cultures where the sacred images always in that's why the iconic images always end up as idols. So originally, if we go right back to what we can see of the original teachings of Christ, you can look at things like the Gnostic Gospels, particularly the Gospel of Thomas, where you see very profound sayings and profound contemplations Now that all that, of course, is not useful to people who want to control other people. So what you get is on the superstructure erected on that foundation, which then turns it into its opposite. So the original icon then becomes an idol.
And you know, it was very strange when I was in Ireland, and we went to the Isle of near Rosslare. Mm. There's an isle dedicated to the White Lady. And there were writings as you're going on. It's a pilgrimage site for Catholics.
Yeah.
But the writings on the plaques were extraordinarily profound.
Mm-hmm.
It was completely pointing to an inner process. I wasn't expecting it from. I know nothing about Catholicism at all. But there were very profound writings that were quite shamanic, really.
Well, one of the odd things you get about Catholicism, and I'm no great fan of the Catholic Church at all, it's appalling in lots of its ways, but it maintains within itself the presence of the feminine, admittedly in quite an emasculated way. But the divine feminine keeps turning up in odd ways in Catholicism, in slightly heretical ways. You get Our Lady of Guadalupe, or we get the... So you get these visionary appearances that bring in the sense of the miraculous and form little subcultures within the larger body of the Christian Church. And there's something about that, the centrality of the feminine, really, which, of course, when we come back to the Book of Gates, this is when we're at a time in human history where the centrality of the feminine was completely known, and so the central image that we keep meeting time and time again in the Book of Gates is the Serpent Mother in her different forms, and of course the central idea behind in the Serpent Mother is this idea of constant transformation. You know, learning to trust the movements, trust whatever you meet, deal with whatever you meet, don't anticipate, but don't look backwards, but keep meeting whatever you meet and allow yourself to be transformed by the encounters that you have. And this is particularly important at this point that we come to, really, where we're looking at the rising up of energy. We're looking at the... So this is the place where we really start to welcome in the new. Where we start to... And in that place have to encounter the challenges to that. The challenges in us and the challenges in the world around us to that. Always, always that, yeah. It's the great image, in a sense, of that book, where you're always heading into the darkness and kind of and having to leave behind the known and move into the unknown. So that's exactly it, in a way. And you have this great image in the book, in this eighth hour as well, of the mummy wrapping starting to loosen and breath coming into the nostrils, and the sense of standing up, moving from the supine to the standing.
I went sea kayaking once as a night paddle, and it was quite interesting how when you're paddling in daylight and you see everything coming to you, you're constantly making adjustments and anticipating the waves and how they might affect you. And in darkness, you couldn't see the shape of the waves. And it was amazing how much, actually at some level, I was always over-anticipating in daylight the effect of the waves. It just, you could only do it by feel at night.
Well, that's interesting.
Really fluid, and the boat was fine. It was quite extraordinary. It was like all of that was so unnecessary.
That's quite that's quite interesting, then, isn't it? Because that means you have to be very close up to whatever is immediately happening. So the absence of sense of vision there means that you have to be just very somatically in touch with what actually is touching you. Isn't that interesting?
Like a magic wand, it was fine.
Yeah, fascinating. Well, I guess it would be, because it would take away that whole sense of anticipation. Amazing.
Yeah. Well, so some very sort of subtler, there's fear affecting an alertness affecting everything.
Yeah.
Daylight.
Holly, you want to say something?
Yeah, what are the caverns of Nu? and the return to the home of the Nu.
The caverns of Nu. The Nu. The Nu really is the water of the Nun. The waters of the beginning. Okay. We're going to come on to the immersion in the waters of the Nun quite soon. I can't remember which hour now. Maybe the ninth hour. Yeah, we come in the ninth hour. We will come into the direct relationship with the waters of the Nu or the Nun.
Okay, they're just mentioned in this hour as well.
Yeah, they're mentioned. I think because the underworld has returned, don't they? Let me see where they mentioned.
Page 180. They are returning to the home of the Nu. They are scrutinized for their underworlders. And then later on, it says something about the caverns, or is it before? No, that's caverns of the Nu.
Yeah, it's looking there at those who work in the underworld, making straight, and the. Because in a sense, what's being hinted at there is that this process of making straight, of opening the ways for the new life to come, does open you to the energies of the beginning, the energies of the Nu. So returning to the home of the Nu means to return, to have a connection to that which that's mysterious energy that is underneath all of creation, which is envisaged by the ancient Egyptians as the waters of the Nu, or sometimes called the waters of the Nun, depending on the dialect, really.
Rather like the first time.
Very much the first time. It's another way of looking at the first time, imagine as this great ocean of undifferentiated life out of which everything arises. So in the Egyptian cosmogony, the first island, the dry mound, arises out of the waters. The tree of life grows on top of the mound, and Ra alights upon the tree and calls everything into being. So this is the waters of the Nun represent the energies before manifestation.
And it just says at the end, we give peace to a God who is upon his base.
Yes.
What does the base mean? Is that sort of something to do with being balanced or...
Yeah, it means being balanced. It means being put in the right place. So this refers to this process of separation, where it's using the words mortal and divine. Now, what's mortal here means that which is dead. What's divine is that which is living. So so you separate from the mortal. You return the divine to its base. You connect it to its root in life. So in terms of the process that we're looking at with ourselves, it means that we're looking at separating, letting go of that which is dead, connecting that which is good and alive in us to the roots of life, to the roots of ourselves, to the roots of the universe. And in that way, we are placed upon our base, we are balanced and in connection with the deeper life of the universe.
And that is our seat, as in...
That is our seat, yeah. So that image we have in the front of the Book of Gates, where you're seated upon your serpent holding the star. That's the ultimate reference to that. So when the process is completed, you become this being, seated upon her seat, holding her star. So any other thoughts or questions? We're just at the end of our time, but let's just see if there's any other burning questions just before we finish. No? Okay. We're meeting next in about 3 weeks, I think. We'll just stick to this. Which is quite So the thing to do, I think, is to the thing just to focus on really are the two things. Look at intensifying the middle pillar, in particular, and looking at this, see what happens when I allow the greater flow of energy to come through me. The other place is this communion with the Serpent Mother, in whatever way you feel called to do that. And in order to, and just in, just simply see what draws you. You may literally want to draw something, you may literally just think about serpents, you might, you know, I think there's just, what we're talking about here is something that's quite personal. So seeing what that image, that idea means in your own life, what do you feel drawn to in that? What is it that connects you to the serpent dreaming? And it may not be an image of a serpent, you know, Duncan. It might be the image of the, it might be that picture of the Beatles that you shared with us. So it's whatever connects you to that mysterious sense of a rising life.
Maybe a good time to read that copy of Melusine that you gave us at the start.
Yes, it would be. I mean, as an alternative set of images, I'll talk a bit more about Melusine actually another time. But the whole process around Melusine is an alternative process to working with the Book of Gates. And so you could certainly, yeah, certainly read that and see what you think of that.
Chime in on that. I was just looking at that in the lunch break, and yeah. There's a place where she's married and leaves a trail of husbands who all break the deal to not look through the keyhole and see her in the bar.
Right, she's only gets married once, Rob.
That was another tale in there that I read on that.
There's another tale in there that's about her mother. Her mother also gets married to somebody who breaks I'll need to talk to you properly about Melusine, I guess, because it's a minor key in what we're doing. But the Melusine story is based around the unity together of the masculine and the feminine principles, symbolized by the idea of Raimondan the knight and Melusine the serpent woman, who is half human, half fairy, and who is herself the product of an union between a fairy and a human man. So we're looking really at the, and for fairy you can read the kind of the mysterious, the magical. So we're looking at the, if you like, the union of the magical in ourselves and the grounded aspects of ourselves. And really looking at, I suppose what I would call the what I've called in some places anyway, the marriage of the body of flesh, the body of dream, which gives place to the experience of the body of mystery. Now, what you have in the instance that you described, Rob, is the breakage between the concrete part of ourselves and the fluid and intuitive part of ourselves. Because in the agreement between Raimondan and Melusine, every seventh day she needs to be on her own to immerse herself back in the water so that her serpent self is refreshed. And she asks for privacy when he does this. And he does spy on her, which kind of breaks the trust a little bit. But the marriage doesn't get broken until a later point when he doubts what he's seen and he becomes repelled by her serpent self and repudiates her. Now, this whole territory has a lot to do with these different sides of ourselves. So there is the formed, knowing part of ourself, grounded, structured part of ourself, and that much more fluid, magical, intuitive part of ourself. And how do these parts of ourselves live together? You know, so read, do read the Melusine book and just see what comes up for you around that. You know, I always put it in really because as a sort of alternative. Because again, the key thing about this is we're not trying to become Egyptian. Right? This is not. I'm not saying right now we study Egyptian stuff for the rest of our lives. Actually, the important thing about the Book of Gates is because it so powerfully explores this serpent archetype. The Melusine story also explores it, not in such a detailed way, and in a slightly different way. So there could certainly be some usefulness in looking at that this month if you want to, and bringing some of that material in. Anything else just before we finish? It's interesting, everybody's just going darker and darker as the light fades. It's funny.
I know we're over time.
Hang on.
I'm tempted just to ask you to say something about Warren Kenton.
Warren Kenton. Yes, who's just died.
Who's he?
Warren Kenton, famous Kabbalist, not entirely famous apparently. some of you don't know who he is.
Used his Kabbalistic name, not.
Yeah, he's no. Yes, that's true. I mean, he's probably known better under his name of Zev Ben Shimeon Halevi. He is an interesting. He's a really interesting figure. Was an interesting figure, I have to say now, because he just died. He learned. He's Jewish, but he learned Kabbalah from a Soho group of Kabbalists, in particular from a man called Glyn Davis. But he made it his own, really. And he's a Sephardic Jew, and he united it with his own Sephardic tradition. But he took some of the idea. There was this really kind of remarkable bunch of Kabbalists working around Soho in just after the war. A whole group of guys, quite bohemian guys, and women who came together and in the aftermath of the war and got interested in the Kabbalah, and formed a whole series of different Kabbalah groups. And Warren Kenton was part of that. And he established something called the Toledano School of Kabbalah. I'm very fond of Warren. Was a lovely man, but he was very, very structured. His approach to Kabbalah couldn't have been more different from my own. I'm quite fluid about it, really, and kind of hold it quite lightly. Warren had a very structured form of Kabbalah. He used to work with a tree of 40 spheres that he called Jacob's Ladder, which was brilliant in terms of analysing things, but I always felt was very imprisoning. I never could work with it personally, but he was. I used to go to some workshops he used to do at Regent's Park College, and I went along for a few years and stopped going because he just used to do the same things over and over again. He used to do that deliberately. That was part of his method. You know, but he would literally, it was the same meditations time and time again. It just didn't work for me. But he set up a whole school of Kabbalah, and there's various other Kabbalists out there now that are working in his tradition. And he died 3 or 4 weeks ago, something like that, from a heart attack. He was 87, so he'd had a good go already. But I suppose what was interesting about him really was his, what was complicated about Warren was that he presented, he never really would reveal where he got this Kabbalah from, because he was presenting it as a pure Judaic form of Kabbalah. And it wasn't really. He got it from a London Welshman called Glyn Davis. So Warren for me is somebody I really respected and had some issues with, I suppose, which is why we never got close, really. We kind of, you know, we had a mutual respect, I suppose, but never closeness, really.
What do we know about Glyn Davis, if anything?
I hope to know a little more, because I've just acquired a book by one of his disciples, but not very much. He was one of these bohemian. There was this whole scene in Soho in the 50s that my own teacher Tom was part of, people like Dylan Thomas were in it as well. It was sort of like jazz, poetry, alternative interests kind of world that was going on in Soho in those days. And there was a whole group of people, Glyn Davis being one of them. Another one was a man called Ernest Page. They'd all, you know, been disrupted by the war. They were all kind of ex-servicemen, and looking for meaning, really, as a result of having been to the war. So this and they used to hang around the, it's like beat culture, right? They were hanging around the coffee bars, so you have to imagine this amazingly imaginative, creative kind of time there was in London before. Well, at a time when ordinary people could afford to live in the centre of London, you know, because London, Soho, was a cheap place to live. That's why people used to live there. And Glyn Davis really was a part of this group, and set up a school called Saros, which was around in the 80s and I think early 90s still, I think, but nearly at its end at that point. They basically got the Kabbalah from Dion Fortune and then took it in different directions. So they're quite interesting bunch of figures, really.
It's interesting that they did that when the reaction to the first war seems to have been to become a Catholic. You know, so many writers became Catholics after the First World War. Yeah. Oh, no, and after the second. I'm thinking of people like Evelyn Waugh and people like that. There were loads of them converted.
No, well, I think these guys just were not interested in that. They were interested, specifically in the old, you know, if you imagine that whole beat movement, you know, that happened in the 50s, where they were, you know, these guys come out of the war, they're rootless, they don't have they're living hand to mouth, most of them really, are doing kind of, you know, so, but they're passionate about a new world. You know, if you can imagine that you've been through the war, you've seen what Nazism has done to the world, you want to create something new. So one of the passions all these guys had was to create something new. A lot of them were interested in, so that's why they created so many ideas, different systems, different schools. So there was a whole plethora. There was about six or seven different Kabbalistic schools operating in London at that time. And the other interesting thing about these guys, I think, which I respect about them, is that they liked to be anonymous. So Glyn Davis, for example, there is no picture of, because he didn't want to be known. He was interested and passionate about what he was doing. They weren't selling things. They weren't interested in creating the careers. They were working at so you can imagine little groups of people gathering in small rooms off Soho, you know, and a lot of time not really knowing quite what they were doing. I mean, there was one organization that was actually turned out to be quite an abusive organization that was part of this, called the School of Economic Science. And that was involved in all kinds of child abuse scandals because it was involved with a very charismatic kind of leader. So it's that kind of creative, powerful, let's try something new, don't know what the fuck we're doing sometimes as well, that promote the... So there were good things that came out of that and also some disturbing things as well. And I suppose Warren and Warren's school, I mean, it might have been, I suppose Warren, to be fair to Warren, he might have been in reaction to some of the chaos of all that he created this very ordered and very very disciplined kind of school and body of work. I mean, Warren wrote shitloads of books. I mean, probably wrote 20 books or something. They were certainly worth, if you're interested in Kabbalah, they're certainly worth looking at, but they're of a particular type. I mean, I think with Kabbalistic books, there are masses of Kabbalistic books, and read the ones that appeal to you and don't read the ones that don't would be my general kind of rule of thumb. And in a way, certainly if you look at Warren's work, having worked with me, you'll find enormous differences. Some similarities, of course, but more differences, I would say.
Would you send out a little bit of a book list about Beginner's Guide to the Kabbalist?
Well, I think I've given you the main book I recommend, which is Will Parfitt's book.
Yes.
So that's the first, if you haven't read that, that's the first place to start, really. Kabbalah, actually, you told me the other day, which is the best, I think it was the new Kabbalah for Life. That's the one. Thank you, Ellie. Kabbalah for Life.
Is that the picture book we got given?
No, that's not the picture book. No, the picture book is his book of rather lovely images. Thank you, Benny. Kabbalah for Life is Will's, account of the Tree of Life, really. So that would be the immediate book I would recommend.
Okay.
Not Dog the Earth.
Not who?
No, Gareth Knight, I meant.
Basil's book, Gareth Knight's, also called Basil Will Be. His books are okay. They're a bit old-fashioned now. They're written in the early 70s. Yeah, his Practical Guide to Kabbalistic Symbolism isn't a bad book. It wouldn't be my first choice. So Will's book is particularly good. Will actually has another book which I would recommend, actually. Magic of Psychosynthesis, where he's looking at these. He's looking there partly at the tradition of psychosynthesis, but he's also looking at the Kabbalah as it applies to that. It's quite a good. It's actually a very good book, and so that's quite a useful thing. Do this first. I mean, I'm not a great fan of go away and read a lot about the Kabbalah. I mean, that's what the other book I should say is the Unfortunate Mystical Kabbalah. Again, very old-fashioned, not at all easy to read, but there's some very, very good stuff in that. Ernest Butler's Magic and the Kabbalah or any of Ernest Butler's books actually would be my other recommendations. You don't mostly get them secondhand these days, but. The only problem with Ernest books, as you'll have told, will have noticed from the reading, is they're written in a very, very old-fashioned way. So they're not easy to read, but there's lots of good stuff in his books. But I wouldn't begin there. I would begin with Will's books and see where it takes you from there, really.
I found a really basic, simple book by Ted Andrews. He's American. A Simplified Kabbalah or something like that, which was really accessible and really easy.
Great. Good. I mean, that's again a good idea. Yeah. Anything that you find easy and accessible that helps you to get your own relationship to it is the key thing, really, rather than complexity, I think. You know, it's God knows there are lots of very complicated books written about the Tree of Life. And mostly they're not needed, because what you're wanting is to grow your own tree. So what you're basically... Hi. Hmm?
Hi. Sorry, yes.
Go on.
Have you finished?
No,
grow
go on,
your
yeah.
own tree, you were saying.
Yeah. Go on.
Oh, I was... I don't want to interrupt.
It's all right. Too late.
I was saying... Sorry. Oh, that's
really awful. Go on.
You said grow your own tree. I've lost track. Yes, I feel like I don't want to read any more books.
No, that's fine.
Is that all right? So I feel like
no,
I need to...
I'm not asking. I'm sort of suggesting that that's good, really. Right, so if you know nothing about the Tree of Life, or feel you want to know a little more, that's fine. If you have a handle on the Tree of Life, then the more important thing is to grow your own tree from your own experience. I mean, I don't read books on the Kabbalah much, really. Sometimes will just remind myself of things, but mainly you're looking at building this inner structure.
Well, sometimes I get a little bit anxious about, you know, like all these different names and angels and correspondences, and I feel like I should know it. And I've been reading books since I was quite young, and I can never retain anything like that.
But I don't think that matters, Holly, to be honest. I mean, my own teacher, Tom, would always forget. He used to forget the names of the Sephiroth, which used to drive me mad. Used to drive me mad when I was younger, because in a sense, he was focused on what was essential. And I think these things are useful. I mean, ideas can be useful if they enable us to connect, but they're not essential. Essential, really, is our own... The tree, ultimately, is a diagram of relationship, inner and outer relationships. And it's the felt sense of those relationships and the internal mapping that gives you that is important. And in a way, I suppose, I've talked to everybody, really. I'd encourage people just to certainly don't read loads of books on the Kabbalah. If you find something that helps you understand it, read that. Read it slowly. Read it meditatively. Notice the questions that emerge for you when you explore it. But I suppose, I mean, I guess what I could do, send out an idea of some decent writers in the field, And there are not very many of them, to be honest. It wouldn't take me long. To be blunt.
It kind of depends on who you relate to as well. So, like Ted Andrews did all this stuff about, he's got stuff on fairies and elves and connecting to animals. And so his way is connected with me. So you've got to find a writer or somebody who's working in a way.
Yes, I do think that's right, Fig, which is why I was saying, you know, I couldn't connect to Warren Kenton's books. Well, he's written lots of books that they didn't speak to me. So you've Ted Andrews doesn't particularly connect to me, but he does connect to you. So you need something. The whole point of reading a book, in a way, on this topic, is to help you to connect, to make a living connection to the Tree of Life. And I think... So choose a book that helps you do that, and certainly don't be worried about having to know too much about it. Literally, the whole idea of it is you grow your own tree inside you, so that it emerges using your imagery, your ideas, your concepts, and the whole point of the tree is to create a sort of internal structure that helps you to relate the different parts of yourself together and helps you relate to the different parts of the universe in a way that you continue to grow and flourish, just like a well-planted tree does. So, yeah, don't read a lot. But if you need to read something, find something that speaks to you and then read it slowly.
You can't read a book on how to swim when you're in the pool.
Well, you can, but it didn't go well. You end up with a soggy book and drowning, probably, if you try to do that. And in a way, what I'm presenting you with are some of the key exercises, really, because the Kabbalistic cross and the middle pillar exercises actually will take you an enormously long way. That alone, really. And if we add to that the inner sanctuary and the contemplations that can arise out of that, that can take you even further. Okay.
I feel full up.
Yeah, me too.
Loaded.
Right, so let's just pause for a moment as we end and just take a breath together. And just come back to your bodies just for a second and just feel it, find out where you are. And then I'll just, in a moment, just ring the bell to bring our weekend to an end. But just come back to yourselves. There's been a lot of talking this last hour and a bit. Find out where you are. Thanks very much, everybody. We'll see you in just 3 weeks, which will be nice. And